Coming up on Tech News Today, Google Plus and WordPress cozy up. A crypto researcher gets his post taken down for criticizing the NSA. And Apple. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, September 10th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT9. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, put them in some context for you, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feed. Apple announced a couple of new products on Tuesday morning. The previously announced iOS 7 will arrive on September 18th, along with free iLife iWork mobile apps for purchasers of new iOS devices. Also, the iPhone 5C, it's real. It comes in six colors with a polycarbonate back, replaces the iPhone 5 for $99 and $199 available for pre-order September 13th. And of course, as expected, the iPhone 5S in silver, gold, and space gray with a 64-bit A7 processor, a new M7 chip that reads sensor data without waking up the main system on a chip, a new camera with dual LED flash and a larger sensor, and a new fingerprint sensor to unlock your phone and to let you buy things. Both phones will be available for purchase September 20th in the United States, Australia, Canada, China, France, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the UK.
Google Plus users can now embed their posts anywhere on the web with a JavaScript snippet and the actual embed code. Google Plus joins Twitter, which has long made embeds easy, but also Facebook, which just turned on embed functionality too. But that's not all. Google has partnered with WordPress and TypePad for authorship assignments on search results pages, meaning that they'll automatically be available to everybody who signs into these platforms with Google Plus sign-in.
Johns Hopkins University asked one of its cryptography professors to take down a blog post that discussed the NSA defeating encryption. Now, the university said it received information that the post linked to classified information and used the NSA logo. After looking into the post, the university found that the information linked was not classified and the NSA logo was removed. Johns Hopkins says it was not contacted by the federal government and it's still looking into the origin of the alert.
The Samsung Exynos 5 Octa chip has 8 cores but only can run 4 at a time. Until soon, Samsung is close to launching heterogeneous multiprocessing for the Octa in Q4, which will allow the chip to run any number of cores in any configuration. Android Police reports it's a combo of software and hardware to upgrade, so there's little chance you're going to see this in the newly announced Galaxy Note 3, but new Samsung mobile devices that come along this autumn just might have it.
Snapchat co-founder Evan Spiegel says that the company rivals Facebook in photo volume with around 350 million snaps per day. That's up from 2 million snaps in June, so quite a bit of growth there. The difference, of course, is that a photo or video message sent to friends using Snapchat disappears after a few seconds, but Spiegel says that's a good thing. Quote, the fundamental premise of Snapchat is that it's better and more fun if you delete everything except the things that are really important that you want to save.
Intel is now shipping its fourth-generation Core i3 processors, otherwise known as Haswell, aimed at tablets. Now, the dual-core i3 4012Y processors are part of a new line of processors that draw as little as 4.5 watts of power at a clock speed of 1.5 gigahertz in certain scenarios. Typical power drain is about 11.5 watts. Expect to see these new processors powering the next generation of Windows laptops and tablets.
Netflix is coming to cable TV in the UK, kind of. Virgin Media announced today that Netflix shows can be streamed from the Virgin Media TiVo boxes using an app. Yes, that's like buying a TiVo on your own, except it does make Netflix available to people who didn't buy it on their own. And by the end of the year, that will be 1.7 million UK homes.
Rejoice, Windows developer community! Microsoft has released builds of Windows 8.1 and Windows Server 2012 R2 to its MSDN and TechNet subscription programs, more than a month ahead of the update's official launch date. The OS updates are available as ISO disk images in a variety of formulations, x86, x64 builds, and N editions that ship with Windows Media Player.
Mirrorless cameras have not caught on outside of Japan, which is why they were a no-brainer for Troubled Olympus. The OMDEM-1, with dashes kind of littered throughout, launches today. Olympus claims it's the first mirrorless camera to compete on quality with SLRs. The successor to the E5 will cost you 145,000 yen. That's about $1,500 U.S. for a body-only version, by the way. Olympus hopes sales of the new model can help the camera division break even, so the folks from Olympus's highly profitable endoscopy department will just stop making fun of them at the company picnic.
PayPal introduced a new piece of hardware for vendors called Beacon. It's part of a hands-free payment system where a PayPal user who opts in will be able to pay at a participating retailer without having to take out their phone or wallet. Beacon uses Bluetooth instead of GPS to locate you. Now, PayPal hasn't announced pricing for the Beacon hardware, but Beacon will launch in the fourth quarter of this year.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace. I use Squarespace for my books website, for our Sword and Lasers website, and we want to know what you use it for. We've been showing some of these sites from people, music, beer sites. If you've got a site you've been using on Squarespace, send us a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website. Use the hashtag #TwitSquarespace. We'll take a look, and we might be talking about your site on a future episode. Squarespace, if you don't know, they're constantly improving the platform. It gets better every time I use it. And beautiful designs, 20 new beautiful templates, along with all the other ones they've had for a long time. Style options, you can choose the colors, you can customize, and it's easy to use, incredibly easy to use. Squarespace has an amazing support team. If you do run into a question, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they received a Gold Stevie Award for outstanding service. It starts at just $8 a month. That includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year, as well as hosting, mobile-ready designs. Even their code's beautiful. Start now with a trial, though. You don't have to listen to anything I say. Just try it out. You don't have to give them a credit card or anything. Start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use this offer code, TNT9, and you'll get 20% off, and you'll show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their support of the show, Tech News Today. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. Before we bring in our guest, we're going to do a little time travel. And from the time we recorded this show, talk about what Apple announced. Sarah Lane, you were on the live broadcast with Leo Laporte, Chris Breen, and I almost said Jason Bourne, Scott Bourne. Scott Bourne's much cooler than Jason Bourne. Tell us what happened.
In the event...
Yeah.
Well, it was a mixture of what's new in iPhone hardware and then what's new under the hood. There was the iPhone 5C. It was not a huge surprise from what we thought it was. $99 for the 16-gigabyte version, $199 for the 32-gig. Comes in five different colors, yellow, blue, green, white, and pink. Also has a variety of interesting cases that are designed to be sort of mixed and matched, really. You get a yellow iPhone, and then maybe you have a blue case, and there's a little bit of a circular grid cutout on the back of the phone, which I immediately made me think of Connect 4, the game, which is probably what Apple did on purpose because they
totally
wanted
the whole
thing to be, yeah, light and colorful. It also matches the colors, the new color palette in iOS 7, so... That makes sense. Then, of course, we've got the iPhone 5S, which is still available in black, which is now being called space gray, plus silver, plus gold. Now, of course, the silver and gold are really both white iPhone faces with either a silver backing or a gold backing. Those prices, 16 gigabyte starts at $199, 32 gig, $299, and the 64 gig, $399 with some fancy little leather cases that go for $39. Now, interestingly, and there are some conflicting reports on, depending on which tech blog you read, but straight from the Apple store itself, the 5C, the iPhone 5C pre-orders are supposed to start this Friday, the 13th, but the iPhone 5S does not have a pre-order date. It's ordering in-store or online, both on September 20th. Which makes me think it sounds like they're trying to get the momentum back for iPhone launch day. They've de-emphasized that the last couple of years, leading some to wonder, why do people line up at stores anymore where you could just pre-order and then get it that day? But maybe Apple's trying to get some frenzy back. And the 5S got a new camera. Some bells and whistles here. Larger sensor, bigger pixels, new flash called True Tone, auto image stabilization, slow-mo video, which was rumored in the past, is supported as well. If you're shooting in slow-mo mode, you kind of have a neat option to shoot the video at a regular speed and then decide which part of that video would be slow-mo. That in slow-mo mode, it's a 720p video as opposed to 1020p in normal video mode, but it shoots at 120 frames per second for that nice slow-mo. And in general, I mean, some of that is software, but in general, that's kind of the hardware stuff. A lot of people were saying, well, are the phones any bigger? No, they're exactly the same size as the 5S. 4-inch screen, up from 3.5 in the 4S. And no mention of the 5C coming to China Mobile, which was previously rumored, although we did hear that the phones would be available on NTT Docomo in Japan, which is the largest carrier in Japan and previously did not carry the iPhone. So sort of half of those rumors ended up being true, though China Mobile is a huge, huge, huge carrier, and they certainly would have mentioned it if it was coming to China Mobile. So that's kind of a glaring omission. Did any of this surprise and delight any of us, or is it sort of business as usual?
I think the only thing that surprised me was the 64-bit processor, and that definitely, I don't know if it delighted me, but it caught my attention. I'm like, that's a powerful processor. Not sure exactly what I'm going to do with it in a phone, but I like to have more capability than I need in my computing devices. So I'm sure there'll be things that it can take advantage of. And the fact that it's not going to have a problem running 32-bit apps means I don't have to worry about backward compatibility. It might be a little bit of a headache for the developers. The other stuff was all as expected. The fingerprint sensor is intriguing. Probably when you think about, okay, the last time we had an iPhone, it was about maps and a longer, you know, bigger screen. And the time before that, it was Siri. This is one of the more significant advances on the iPhone in a while. But overall, pretty much what we expected and fairly incremental.
Yeah, I didn't even mention the Apple innards portion of this. We've got the A7 system on a chip. Of course, 64-bit mode, although even though Apple apps will all be in 64-bit, iOS 7, I'm really getting confused with all these numbering conventions here, will support 32-bit apps. Of course, you know, Tom, you mentioned, well, what's the 64-bit going to mean? You know, they mentioned that right before Epic Games came up on stage and announced Infinity Blade 3 and touted how the graphics are infinitely, see what I did there, better than before. Mm-hmm. Not infinitely, about twice as good as the original iPhone. Then, of course, we've got an M7 motion compressor, a co-processor, as they call it. Gyroscope, accelerometer, a compass that's all sort of built into one. It seems like that is going to really play into fitness apps, stuff that requires moving and different ways that you might be moving around with the phone on your person or certainly near you. Touch ID fingerprint sensor, I'm excited to use it. I guess the only thing I'm really worried about is if I'm unconscious, can someone get into my phone?
I don't know if it checks for pulses. They did say any orientation.
If I'm unconscious, I still have a pulse.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I'm just kind of curious. Well, maybe you're not going to have the same kind of pulse. But anyway, maybe you have an excited state. I'm going to buy another iPhone. That's going to be another thing. They don't have a pulse notification.
The iPhone says, you're not excited enough to use this. No entry.
Like, no. Anyway, the 5S has that ring around it. It's not a button anymore, right? That's not a depressible button.
No, it's a button.
It is still a button.
It's a button with a silver ring around the edge.
I thought it was just still a capacitive button, though. I didn't think it was.
No, it's really just has that silver bell and whistle that's designed to note when your thumb or your finger is incoming.
I think I know what you're saying. Will it feel the same as the current button, which you feel depressed with that capacitive sensor? Will it just be like a capacitive touch keyboard? That's a good question.
Either way, I don't think the actual hardware itself seemed underwhelming. We've seen all of this leak. They even mentioned that in the keynote, which is not something Apple normally likes to do. And now it seems like, yeah, you've probably seen this. You've probably known about this. And they're talking about the colorful ones, the iPhone 5C. We have the 5S, which looks pretty good. It just, I don't really see a huge reason to upgrade if you have a 5, unless you just really want a color. Then you can just buy one of these cases instead. They're, what, $30? Put them on top of there, and it's all right. As for the mention of the A7 and the M7, I was actually kind of curious that Apple bothered to even talk about the M7. It used to be about like the magic of the phone and how it can do what you want it to do. Now it's like, we're actually going to talk about specs and what makes it different. Just kind of curious how the M7 is going to play into their future plans.
Yeah, I think that, well, it didn't surprise me that they talked about the M7, but I know what you're saying. The last couple of announcements from Apple have been a lot more about specs than we used to get. We used to never see the words floating point up on a slide, and we saw 2x floating point up there today. I think the M7 is very intriguing, and Leo mentioned this on the Apple coverage earlier. I think they definitely are paving the way for some kind of accessory, some kind of wearable accessory, maybe a watch that can communicate with your phone even when it's off and in your pocket without draining the battery.
Also, another question that I think comes up with people is the fingerprint sensor, not just if you're unconscious, but hey, if you, does that, what happens? How strong is it going to be? Because if you err on the side of, yeah, we think that's your finger, then you certainly don't want that. But it still will have the passcode as a backup. And you can You can even turn off the fingerprint sensor if for whatever reason. You're like, eh, I just prefer to use a passcode. That makes me feel better about it. Also, Apple claims there will be nothing stored in iCloud, nothing stored on servers. All fingerprint ID information will be encrypted. And yeah, it's somewhat impossible to know exactly what's getting captured at all times, but it's certainly not looking like it's anything to be too alarmed about at the beginning. I'm excited to use it, and you can add multiple fingers as well if you really trust somebody to open to unlock your phone.
Oh, see, I thought that was for just like I can open it with my index finger or my pointy finger. I thought it was
well,
for
that's
me.
True, but Apple's not going to be able to say, "Oh, that index finger isn't yours." No way. It's
that's
you,
a good
you basically
point. Yeah.
You get 3 fingers or something like that.
And I noticed that they showed the password as an option on buying things when you're in the iTunes store. But I wasn't clear if you can still have that available and the fingerprint sensor on the phone's lock screen. Because if you can, or if that's the way it works, then it really doesn't add any extra security. Because anybody could just say, oh, well, I stole the guy's lock code. I'm just going to bypass the fingerprint sensor. It becomes more of a gimmick at that point.
I think it's more of like a convenience thing. Like when you download an app or any of those little moments where you need to authenticate constantly, if it does add or makes it easier to buy applications, I think that might be Apple's real game here. So instead of like typing your password and that gets screwed up, you're like, I'm going to spend, you know, $5 for this app, $8 for this app. It could add up over time, especially if it's very, very easy to spend money since your credit card is still hooked up into Apple servers.
In any case, if you want one, September 13th to pre-order the cheap one, which really isn't that cheap. $549 unlocked for the 16-gigabyte 5C, by the way. $649 unlocked for the 64-gigabyte 5S. And both those phones go on sale September 20th. So let's bring in our guest, David Berlind, editor-in-chief of Programmable Web, a heritage blog. And you just started there a couple months ago. And congratulations on the new job, man.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for the compliment, Tom. Yeah.
Absolutely. Great to have you to talk about some stuff that's not Apple that's in the news today as well. Google Plus launching those embeds that we heard about in the news few, Zayas.
Yeah, so Google launched an embed feature so users of Google Plus can embed public posts using JavaScript and the actual embed code. Although it sounds like, I mean, I haven't worked on a website in a long time, but it sounds like you'd have to have full control of the site since you have to add the JavaScript code to before you close the body tag. So maybe for your own personal sites. The embedded post looks like a Google Plus card, familiar profile pictures, options to follow, hashtags, comments below the post. And if the post is edited on Google Plus, it'll update the embedded version. Google has a list of supported types of posts. It'll support posts with images, videos, with links to a community, but it will not support posts from within a community, posts restricted to a Google Apps domain, private posts, events posts, and Hangout on Air posts. So it's pretty limited as to what you can actually embed on the web. Google also announced that Blogger users can automatically share their blog posts directly to Google+, and Google's partnering with WordPress and Typepad to support signing in with Google and being a part of Google's authorship program. That's when you look at the search results and you see a little image of the author there. Google will highlight the name and picture and link to your Google Plus profile when it finds it. David, do you think this, if you see Google Plus around the web like this with all these cards, you think this is going to popularize the social network with the Facebook types, or is this just, eh?
Well, you know, depending on who's using Google Plus to publish their content, it could work, it could not. If there's something compelling in the box when it happens to show up, like, say, on TechCrunch or something like that, there are some prominent bloggers out there who spend more of their time on Google Plus and other networks. So to the extent that you want to embed their content in your blog, then maybe that's that will work. But I think the authorship part is really the more important of the two announcements. If you've been following what Google's doing with authorship, they're basically saying that, you know, if you go to Google News or Google Search and you've got all the authorship wiring in place, then when you look at a post, you'll also see the author's picture. You'll see how many circles they're in. You'll be able to click through to their Google Plus profile. You'll be able to do all these things. Nice functionality, but what a lot of SEO experts theorize, although Google hasn't been very straightforward about it, is that Google Plus authorship will begin to matter in the search result ranking. And so if you're a publishing site like we are, programmableweb.com, and we want to make sure that we're getting as much visibility as we possibly can, we're looking at that and we're saying, well, wait a minute, Google's probably changing the rules here. And unless we have Google authorship wired into all of our pages, then we might not get as good a ranking as we would normally get. So, you know, when it comes to them doing a deal with WordPress and other publishing infrastructure, what was the other one? It was WordPress and
TypePad.
And TypePad. First of all, my question is, who's still using TypePad?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
We are very big fans of Drupal. I would love to see Drupal included in that because I would love to be able to wire all of our pages for Google Plus authorship without having to jump through a bunch of hoops. But, you know, this is really Google using its power in the search market to force people to go over to Google Plus as a social network. Because if there's a fear like the one we have, that unless we include Google Plus on our pages, we won't get the sort of ranking that we really want, then what choice do we have?
Yeah, I think Google, that's a really good call. Google needs to make it clear that if you don't use Google Plus, that it won't affect your search engine rankings. And they have done things like that in the past when they've come under criticism for rankings. I don't know if they'll continue to do them. And Google is getting too powerful. The other thing that concerns me about this is sign-in. The convenience of using Google as your sign-in provider is great. But given the current security concerns, I don't know if I want all of my information being routed through Google, because Google can't even protect all their information all the time. And it's very sad to me that OpenID is closing down, because I think we really more than ever need some kind of independent, secure way to log into multiple sites.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one of the issues here is that how do you, you know, pick which one of these mechanisms you're going to use to authenticate to your various sites? What if, let's say, I'm using WordPress now? In fact, if you look at Programmable Web today, it's largely based on WordPress. And we all have our regular logins, or let's say we're logging in with Facebook. Now I'm being asked to switch to another authentication mechanism. What would my motivations be to actually make that switch? So the authentication bit to me is kind of like, meh, who cares? Because everybody's already authenticating, and I don't know that a lot of people are dying to authenticate with their Google Plus credentials. But it's more of the authorship piece that I'm looking at and thinking, wow, that's pretty big news. It's just another example of Google pushing Google Plus down at a lot of other publishers, especially ones who are using WordPress and TypePad. And, you know, it will only be a matter of time, if you talk to most search engine optimization experts, before it's very clear that this sort of authorship matters when your site, like, you know, this week, you know, Twit TV or Programmable Web or CNET or any one of those sites.
Stay tuned for a future Tech News Today when we answer angry emails from TypePad users. Let's move on to cryptography researcher Matthew Green. This was submitted on our subreddit by SP Sheridan, assistant research professor at Johns Hopkins University. I was actually, if you watched the video I made last Friday of how I prepped for the show, I was actually reading this guy's article on Friday about the NSA crypto breaking. He was asked by the dean to take down his post. He took it down from the university service. He left it up on his own personal Blogger account. He was told he needed to remove the logo of the NSA from both, which he did, and that the university told Ars Technica they had received links that he was linking to classified material. Turns out he was linking to the public reports about classified material. Green said on his Twitter account he was told that someone at the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins was the source of the request. A university spokesperson, Dennis O'Shea, told Ars Technica, "We did not receive an inquiry from the federal government about the blog or any request from the government to take down the Mirror site. As to where the information came from, we are still tracing the path of this event, which all exploded into our notice over the past couple of hours." That's a quote from O'Shea. The NSA logo has to stay down, but the links, the university say, appear to be to news media, and so the Mirror may be restored. Last I checked, Green hadn't put it back up on his Johns Hopkins blog. But which bothers you more about this story, the mysterious nature of the request or the fact that they were using copyright? Take down that logo, or I guess trademark, maybe, to chill speech. David, what do you think?
Well, look, this is the day and the age of the web, and logos are widely used across the web, lifted from one site and put in another, just to provide some sort of artistic background to or something that the text can wrap around. To put the NSA's logo, if you looked around the web at how many articles probably have the NSA logo on them, it would be mind-boggling. You'd suddenly realize this is a non-issue. And for the school to make a big issue out of that is very surprising to me. You know, I also was looking at the story, the one that's still up on his own site, and I thought, well, which could have been the offending link if there was any particular link that was offensive? And, you know, it was funny. I went through and I realized, you know, he does a lot of linking there. He's got links to the New York Times, ProPublica, Guardian, National Institutes of Standards, Wikipedia. But there's this one link, I don't know if you look through them, Tom, that was really kind of interesting. It goes to rump2007.cr.yp.to/15-schumau.pdf. It's further down in the story, and this is a slide deck that was offered up by two people who work for Microsoft, and it really puzzled me as to why they posted that slide deck on a site, on a site that's based in Tonga. Now, I don't even know where Tonga is. Does anybody know where that is? And why would you take
French Polynesia?
It's in Polynesia. I think it's somewhere around Fiji, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether maybe this was the offending link or not, because it does go into the vulnerabilities to a standard encryption technology. And maybe this is what they thought was sensitive. I was just trying to figure out which one of these links was most sensitive. But that particular link really jumped out at me, especially since it comes from two people who work for Microsoft. Why don't they publish it on the Microsoft website?
Yeah, I've been trying to remember what the deal is with law enforcement logos and trademark laws, because it's a particularly gray area. You can't just like take a law enforcement logo and put it on a T-shirt and sell that, as you saw. I think last week there was a problem with like NSA doing that. They're using something that I think is a gray area, but there is reasoning behind it. So that way you're not creating this false idea that this is NSA based or whatever. But
it falls under the fair use factors, though. He's doing commentary.
As it's a news story, or if it's a discussion of it, criticism. That
academic
seems like,
commentary. Yeah,
sounds like it'd be totally fine. So, but that's the thing. Like it is still. Something that could be used a little bit strangely. But the NSA is not exactly known for doing things on the up and up right now anyway, so I don't know if that's surprising. As the whole university process, that seems a little strange to me too. It's like, okay, so we got this email. We don't know where it came from, apparently. The fact that the Johns Hopkins University said, we're still looking into the origin. That's what's confusing.
But we went ahead and told them to take it down without finding out where the request comes from. But
take it down and we can put it back up. Maybe they figure it's better to ask for forgiveness of the professor than to run afoul of whoever sent him the email.
Very definition of the chilling effect right there. Let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show. Appropriately enough, ProXPN. More than ever before, your online freedom is suspect. Governments, ISPs, all kinds of nefarious people at the coffee shop or on the airport Wi-Fi might be trying to sniff your packets. And one way to protect yourself in a suite of things to protect yourself is a VPN. Especially if you're at that free Wi-Fi at the coffee shop, you want to shut down those people running those little sniffers so they don't see your traffic going to the Wi-Fi access point. Using a 512-bit encryption tunnel like the one from ProXPN is a great choice. It works by OpenVPN or PPTP. It'll stop people from filtering. It can stop geographic restrictions. It's for Windows and Mac, but they've also got the ability to configure it for Linux, configure it for your phone. In fact, there's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN, so you don't have to do any configuring at all. Right, customer support. I use it. And Steve Gibson from Security Now gave it a great review. And that's kind of what convinced me that this was worth looking into. If you'd like to try it out, go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year. We've got a special offer. Use the code TNT to receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TNT. We thank ProXPN for their support of Tech News Today. PayPal's getting into the hardware business, Ayaz. What's this about?
Yeah, so they're trying to take on Square again. They have this new piece of hardware. It's this tiny, like, looks like a USB stick that goes, you could power it with a USB power supply. And it's supposed to allow for hands-free shopping. So here's the deal. A store installs this little beacon device in their place of business. That device works with a compatible point-of-sale system, and there's a bunch of them, including things like Leaf and ShopKeep, Vend, a whole bunch of those. And then the person who's opted in, the PayPal user who's opted in, when they walk into the store, will be able to say, I'm going to order, you know, a cup of coffee. It's fine. The payments are done that way. It's kind of like Square. Pay with Square, but the thing is, it doesn't use GPS because that sucks down lots of battery life. This uses Bluetooth, which takes a lot less energy. So this is supposed to be the new way for PayPal to allow for hands-free payments. However, they're only testing this out with a handful of vendors in the fourth quarter. A larger rollout is expected next year. PayPal hasn't mentioned what the device costs. They said it'd be in the double digits, so that could be like what, $10 to $99 for a shopkeeper to get this. David, do you see vendors picking up this device? Do you think people are going to be on PayPal's side when it comes to hands-free payments?
Well, first of all, I'm a user of PayPal. I buy and sell stuff on eBay all the time, and you know, PayPal is the preferred method of payment on there. And I actually have funds in my PayPal account, and I always kind of I'm a little depressed when I go around the web and I find that so many merchants on the web don't accept PayPal, let alone going out to merchants that are, you know, brick and mortar merchants and trying to find some of those who accept PayPal. If you look around, you can see, you know, that the different companies that provide quote unquote wallet technology, they're all trying to figure out how they insert themselves into these brick and mortar transactions. So, you know, we're talking about Google, of course, Apple will want to be involved with that, Microsoft, and now PayPal. And so the question is, really, should there be a standard to allow for all of them to participate without having them putting the burden on the merchant to have to support four different technologies like this one in their store or, you know, in their place of business? That to me seems to be a little bit problematic.
So if I understand this correctly, PayPal last week rolled out a new app that was reimagined to be a lot more like Square, plus mm-hmm. being able to order stuff at certain restaurants using E24 ahead of time. What is this for people who say, I don't want the PayPal app, I just want some other solution? Do you have to carry around a dongle with you?
No, the dongle's that's installed by the shopkeepers.
So it's still talking to your phone?
Yes.
Yeah, if you watch the video on the TechCrunch article, you'll see there's a woman walking around with a purse, and it's sort of clearly noting, you know, that the phone is in her purse, and she just walks into a store, and she picks up her merchandise and walks out. It's really a hands-free transaction. And what's happening behind the scene is that the phone is somehow communicating with this dongle that's plugged into the wall and conducting the transaction without any involvement from either the merchant or the customer.
But I don't understand how that's so different than geofencing unless we're specifically talking about it being a better battery life issue.
It's not like PayPal's trying to hang their hat on the power savings you'll have on your phone. So instead of you walking around having your GPS drain your device, you'll use Bluetooth, which uses a lot less energy.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're covering all their bases, I suppose. I guess in that way, it's good. I just don't, I'm not sure how they say, hey, we've got this great solution. Here's our wonderful new reimagined app. And here's our other solution for all of you who don't want to use our wonderful new app. You know, it's almost like it's competing with itself.
Maybe it's like a belt and suspenders approach. PayPal seems to be trying everything. That new app is confusing anyway.
Over the place.
So maybe that's what PayPal's mindset is right now. Just kind of do everything at once and see what sticks. Maybe Beacon won't take off, or maybe the app will, or the other way around. Maybe they just want to have this thing to compete with Square.
I've always loved Square's ability to pay without taking the phone out of my pocket. Of course, it's geofencing. It works differently. But if they can make this work seamlessly on the end, and I just have to have two apps on my phone, maybe one for Square, one for PayPal, and that becomes ubiquitous, as an end user, I'm fine with that. That's great.
But does that mean that the merchant has to have both the Square technology and the PayPal technology on their premises? And
no, because I have both apps, so they can pick one. They can have one or the other.
Right. So what you're saying is depending on where you go, as long as one of those things works, you're happy.
Yeah, as a consumer, I'm happy. Maybe the merchant isn't happy. Maybe they get a better deal from one or the other.
So, Tom, would you also load the equivalent technology from Google and Microsoft, and that way you have the most coverage?
Well, yeah, then it's a great question, right? Because now it's starting to get complicated how many of these are. And it would be good to have some kind of open standard. Again, going back to our who's got control of the information. But more competition, I think, is good. So yeah. I wouldn't mind a few different providers out there for sure. Mm-hmm. Let's finish up with competition in the game console market. Horace Dediu at Dirk Schmidt of Simco, they're pretty respected analysts as analysts go, have done an article graphing out mobile and fixed game console sales, and it does not look good. Nintendo, of course, everybody knows is struggling, and Nintendo comes off the worst. They are not creating a new era of sales. Sales spike at release time. Usually they go up for a while and then start to come back down to earth. In fact, the Wii is the best example of this. But the Wii U and the 3DS and the 3DS Lite, none of them are going up. They spike at sales and then immediately start to fall down. Nintendo's sales peaked overall for all their consoles, mobile or fixed, back in Q3 2008 at the height of the Wii sales. Microsoft and Sony consoles are declining, but of course you could say, well, that's the end of a long cycle for them. We've got the Xbox One. We've got the PS4 coming out. That will come as well. But the Sony portables, the PS Vita, are declining as well. We're not seeing, again, that arc. We're just seeing a drop after release. And the more damning graph in there is combined console sales. When you add Nintendo to Microsoft to Sony over this entire period of the last 10 years, sales peaked at Q3 2008, and they have declined steadily since. They sort of error correct each other for the peaks and valleys. They say in this report, like other applications that used to have systems built around them conforming to their needs, the dedicated purpose solutions came to be absorbed into the general purpose platforms. And in this article, they're saying the general purpose platform is mobile devices. The gaming is being absorbed into those. As mobile devices get inexorably better, they will be hired for use in the setting. Interesting phrasing. Hired for use in the setting where consoles have been king, the living room. David, do you agree with this conclusion? Is this the death knell for game consoles as a specialty device?
I completely agree with that. I think that if you use my household as a really good example, we have three children here. We have a game console, and it is collecting dust. And why is it collecting dust? Because each of the kids can choose one of the tablets to play the game of their choice, as opposed to having to fight over which game is going to get played on the console. Now, you know, the article, that as you read the text, you pointed out as the mobile devices get better. And remember, at the top of the hour, there was a little bit of a story about Samsung introducing an 8-core processor. And this is Moore's law in effect. And what you're seeing happening is that the mobile devices are getting more and more and more powerful and more capable of doing all the same things that game consoles used to be able to do, with the one exception is that I can take it anywhere I go. I don't need a Game Boy or something like that, or a PS2. What was the Sony device, the one that the portable device? I'm sorry?
The Vita?
You don't need one that's dedicated to a particular platform. You just have an iPhone or an Android device, and if you're a game maker, you're going to make sure your games work on those devices, because that's your biggest market at, you know, $1.99 or $3 a pop. So I really, you know, just watching what's going on in my household, I truly believe that the days of the game console are seriously numbered, because that thing is just upstairs collecting dust, and it's the three or four tablets that we have laying around and the smartphones that the kids grab to play their games.
I mean, it suggests that Microsoft's got the right bet, right? They're trying to make the Xbox One a media box. They have smart glass, which works with pretty much any device there is, Windows tablets, your phone, your iPhone, Android phone. They don't care. As long as, I mean, Xbox Music just showed up on iOS and Android. So that might be the right strategy. Sony going with the idea of pleasing the gamers first. It's not like Sony abandoned Sony Unlimited and all their music services. So they still have that. So maybe the idea of a game console, it's kind of like that, the MP3 player or the PDA, eventually just kind of merges into something, or like it turns into something else. I think that these boxes are changing what they are, because I've got a PS3. I think the last time I played a game was a very long time ago, but I watch Blu-rays and stream content on it all the time.
Dang it. It's an interesting article, and a lot of people are saying, hey, Xbox One and PS4 are going to come out in November in North America, and we're going to see a big spike. These guys account for that. They say, yes, you're going to see a big spike, but their prediction is that there will not be a continuous rise as there have been with other consoles, and the continuing disappointment of the Wii U is going to mean that even with those two spikes, the overall game console market is not going to rise. It's going to continue to decline, but we'll have to check back in a quarter or two and see if they're right. It's pretty compelling stuff if you take a look. We'll have the link in the show notes, or you can just go to Asymco, ASYMCO.com. It's up there at the top of their site right now. Let's finish up with a randomizer. Some people are saying Jimmy Kimmel just won the internet. He definitely trolled it. I don't know how. I did not get caught up in the twerking girl whose pants caught on fire. But apparently a lot of people did. In fact, a lot of news stations were running it as a story. And it turns out the whole thing was faked by Kimmel.
It's obviously fake.
Agreed.
Come on.
When I saw it, I was like, the shot's too good.
The shot is too good. Yeah, this is supposed to be some sort of a webcam. And then there's like a cut. And that's weird. Yeah,
lining up everything.
The question was only who did this, rather than is this real.
At least he bothered to end this stupid thing already. It's already over.
Also, it's like light outside. Where's the candle coming from?
Well, you know, she just wanted to set the mood. And yeah, now we're watching the video where,
of course,
you didn't see before Jimmy Kimmel coming in and.
Of course, you know, whenever you do twerk upside down, you make sure you have lighter fluid on your pants so you can catch on fire that quickly, because you know fabric goes up like that.
Hey, maybe she uses a lot of hairspray.
I was thinking that maybe it was a viral video by a stunt person. Like, oh, okay, we got somebody actually did some actual special effects.
You were three quarters right.
And I was like, nah, it turns out it's just a television show.
We've gotten to the point where these viral, like, video, can't believe this happened, no one believes it's real anymore because it usually isn't. And all of our viral songs are like just sort of funny now, but we all go, this is the new viral song. What the fuck it's so funny. But it's not really.
I can't believe that that Jimmy Kimmel couldn't get Miley Cyrus to do that video for him. He's pretty well connected, isn't he?
Yeah, one would think.
Yeah, and she didn't look like Miley Cyrus at the VMAs, so maybe nobody would have recognized her. Apparently some friends of this woman recognized her and were emailing her asking her, are you okay? What happened? She's like, I'm a stunt woman. Of course I'm okay. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We've got a message from Rich in Westbury, New York. He says, love the show. I was listening to today's show, and you guys were talking about the idea of digital license plates. And Tom was saying that the device shouldn't have GPS on it. It seems like everyone is so caught up on the idea of government spying that they don't see the benefits of GPS on a license plate. It seems like once a week I'm driving down the parkway, and I see a sign lit up that says Amber Alert, missing adult gray Toyota plate number ABC1234. If that license plate had GPS in it, that adult would no longer be missing. I just thought it was an important point to bring up. Keep up the great work. Again, I love this show.
All right, Rich. No, it's a fair point. There obviously will be benefits from any kind of technology that's tracking like this. My guess is, though, if somebody is on the run, they're likely to figure out a way to stop the GPS or take off the plate or replace the plate. Or even hack the plate and change the number so it's not the right number anymore. I don't know. To me, I don't know how you guys feel, it doesn't outweigh the privacy implication. That's just me. Well, that's the end of our show.
I agree with you.
All right. David Berlin, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let folks know what's going on at programmableweb.com. You've got some interesting stuff in the works, I hear.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I took over like about a month and a half ago, and we're currently under the hood looking at how programmable web was originally built and figuring out ways that we can improve upon what's already there. We have a lot of developers who come to us. For those of you who don't know what programmable web is about, it's really, I'll go back to what TechCrunch said about us. They said that we are the journal of the API economy, And today's applications, especially ones that are running on smartphones and web applications, 90% of them are relying on some sort of API to get their functionality or their data from somebody else, for example, Google Maps. And this is exactly the economy, if you want, the ecosystem that programmableweb.com documents. We document it for both the developers who want to use those APIs. We also document it for the providers of the APIs and the companies that make tools to make those applications easier to develop. And so we're looking at it now. We're looking at the alert mechanisms, for example, a very favorite feature of many of the developers. They get alerted anytime something changes with an API that they use. We're looking at all these little features that are in the site that our audience members love, and we're figuring out a way to take them to the next level. So I would say probably in the next month or two, you're going to see some big changes on the site. Stay tuned to programmableweb.com.
Definitely. I know we've got a lot of big fans of that site in the chat room. They've been talking about it. So check it out, programmableweb.com. Also, don't forget about our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. It's one way to suggest stories for the show. Put them in there, vote them up, vote them down, make some comments. Let us know what you would like us to talk about. It's one of the things we look at when we prepare the show every day. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow with the newsman, Mike Hurley, from 5x5 on the show. We'll see you then.